A sharp wind came in, past the yellowed grass of the field, past a little metal fence, past the barrack-style buildings that comprised the tiny campus. Booby wore number 3 and looked gorgeous and powerful. But he was buried mercilessly by the Bulldogs, the number 1 rated junior college team in the country. He juked and spun and did all the things that LV had taught him, but without much success. "Come on," yelled a teammate from the sideline. "Lower your shoulder and run over his ass. Stop juking." LV watched silently from the bleachers. He had gotten off the late shift at the Exxon station where he was working and had made the 200-mile trip to Ranger from Odessa with some friends.
"Couple of years of this, you'll be ready,"
said LV as he watched Booby get battered by the Navarro defense on the way to a 31-0 loss. Navarro was a strong team, but Booby clearly wasn't the same runner he had once been. He was as fearless as ever, but his knee was still weak and swelled up easily with fluid. Because of the protective braces that he wore on both knees to prevent further injury, he no longer had the breakaway speed that the big-time college recruiters had once upon a time found so enticing. "A person like me can't be stopped. If I put it in my mind, they can't stop me. Ain't gonna stop me. See if I can get a first down. Keep pumping my legs up. Spin out of it. Go for a touchdown. Go as far as I can." Those words were just a memory now. "I've never seen that burst of speed," said the head coach of Ranger, Joe Crewson. "I don't know how many times he got caught from behind." "It's hard when you have greatness and it's taken from you, and you just can't get it back in your hands." Booby seemed frustrated and discouraged after the Navarro game. But LV, as always, was there to console him and give him support and keep the dream alive. He told him that his offensive line had been just about hopeless, and there wasn't much a running back could do if the people in front of him didn't know how to block. They stood together, talking softly, sometimes not talking at all, but drawing strength from one another in the absence of anyone else. In the fading afternoon light of Ranger, Texas, with that bitter wind blowing across the field, flanked by the malarial yellow of the dormitory where Booby lived, they looked quite beautiful. The city of Odessa moved forward with some signs of economic relief. The price of oil itself hovered around $20 a barrel for much of 1989, an improvement of roughly $5 a barrel over 1988, and there were even predictions that a worldwide shortage might push the price of oil even higher. People in Odessa had been burned so many times by predictions that they tended not to pay much attention to them. But there was a belief that at least things could not get worse. Whatever happened, it seemed clear that the fate of Odessa lay in the hands of others, like the automobile industry and the steel industry and the semiconductor industry. The domestic oil industry had become a follower on the world market. The decline in U.S. oil production in 1989, 6.8%, was the largest drop ever in any single year. Imports rose to 46%, their highest level in 12 years, and OPEC's noose around the West Texas oil patch was as tight as it had ever been. Outside of the economic news, there wasn't much change in other areas. A new quality of life study came out in the fall of 1989, and as usual, Odessa distinguished itself. The revised volume of the Places Rated Almanac rated Odessa the second worst place to live in the country out of the 333 that were studied. Odessa, according to the almanac, had the worst health care in the country and ranked in the bottom 25 in the categories of transportation, jobs, and recreation. Some folks were upset with the ranking, but after a few outbursts, life went on as normal, and people latched on to the same things they always had. The speeches were the same, and so were the looks on the faces. It could have been Brian Chavez, or Jared McDougal, or Mike Winchell, or Ivory Christian, or Booby Miles. But it was December of 1989 now, instead of December of 1988, and the names were Harvey Villa, and Kevin Mannix, and Chris Comer, and Stoney Chase, and Johnny Seeley, and Jeff Garrett. Otherwise, everything seemed untouched, a cycle destined to repeat itself forever, an interchangeable set of boys, all captive to the same dream, going to state. About an hour before game time, Mike Ballew met with the defensive ends.
They say they're going to shut us out, and they say they're going to beat us like Yates did and all that. That's hard for me to live with, man. That hurts my pride a little bit. It hurts for myself. It hurts me for you guys and for everybody from West Texas, everybody from Odessa. They slandered us in the paper. And now, by God, we're going to take care of business out there on the field, okay? We're going to make it all even on the football field today. This is something that you dream about. And I'm sure you're just like every other little boy that grew up in Odessa. You thought about playing for Permian. Golly, man, here you are in the biggin', in the big house. It's going to be on TV. You got all the elements. Let's get after these guys, okay? Let's get after them. Let's win it for ourselves. Let's win it for our school. Win it for our parents. Let's win it for West Texas.
Minutes before game time, Gaines called the team to gather around him.
Everybody in this room has paid a dear, dear price to be where you are, he told them. That ought to make your effort that much more intense, that much more fanatical, because of all the hard work and sacrifice that's gone into getting you here. It ought to make you play that much harder. You represent a lot of people. We're going to represent them well, and we're going to win this sucker.
They huddled in that long tunnel of Texas Stadium amid cries of, "Let's go, baby, let's go!" They broke through the banner made by the cheerleaders that took up almost half the end zone. They heard the cries of Mojo and the enormous swell of the band. They played with a flawlessness and sense of purpose that had been building inside them all their lives. After it was over, tears flowed freely down their faces and also down the faces of the grown men and women who depended on them year after year after year. It was hard to fathom the shock of what Odessa had gone through during the 80s, from a world where everything seemed possible to one in which it was hard to hold on to anything with certainty. So much had happened, so much had changed. But one anchor was still there, as strong and solid as ever. It didn't really matter who was playing or who was coaching. It would always go on, just as Jared McDougal had realized, because it was a way of life. The Permian Panthers ended the decade exactly the same way they had begun it. 2 days before Christmas, they became the state football champions of Texas. Afterward. 25 years later. I had taken this route once before at a different time in my life. I was much younger then, in my 30s, when you can still act impulsively and not permanently suffer for it. I didn't know what to expect then, and I don't know what to expect now. There's a familiar comfort in the landscape, the sprawl of the Dallas Metroplex like oozing oil, the metallic spires of the refineries in Beaumont and Houston, the hill country dressed in lace and wildflowers, the flatlands of West Texas where you step off into eternity and wonder if you'll find your way back. 1,000 miles through Texas with 1,000 memories. I want to resurrect those memories, or at least the memory of those memories, since I'm now 60, when you forget far more than you remember. I hate going back in my life for the very reason it means going back. and I'm neither a believer in nor advocate of nostalgia. But on the eve of the 25th anniversary publication of Friday Night Lights, I do feel compelled to return. It was a linchpin moment of my life, the moment, to be honest. Return, and not just to famous and infamous Odessa, the controversy that exploded after the publication of the book in 1990 made me a marked man. I had to cancel my book tour there. The anger was palpable. I exposed the good of Odessa because there are many good, hearty, and honest people there. But I also exposed thick veins of racism and misplaced academic and social priorities. It wasn't like you had to go digging around for them. I actually have been back to Odessa many times over the past 25 years, often because of the book or the film version, but other times to see people who have become friends for life. There was tension when I first came back, but Odessans are more forgiving than they think, or maybe they just learned to ignore me, an old shoe, dusty and cobwebbed, kept in a forgotten corner of the closet. Now, the real reason for the return trip is to see the six kids that formed the spine of the book. They were teenagers when I wrote about them. They were kids. But they're in their 40s now, just as I am no longer the 34-year-old from New York City landing in Odessa in 1988, wearing loafers and an old tweed jacket with elbow patches, writing a book that I knew I had to write, even if it meant quitting my newspaper job. I wanted to update the lives of these players for a new afterword, learn of the pathways they had taken and where those pathways had led them. There was a professional motive, but this was personal. I could have done it all by phone and email and internet, easier and cheaper, yet I had to see them face to face. I had to know if there was still any emotional connection between us, if any of the power of what we went through still remained. I loved them then. But love is the most empty and overused word in the English language, after brilliant. 25 years earlier, I had gone in search of the Friday Night Lights. Now, during a week in April, in Texas, I went searching for those who had played under them. If you invented a time machine, you'd be the richest man on the planet. After landing at DFW the night before and picking up a rental car, I started with Mike Winchell. We arranged to meet at the Fort Worth stockyards. As I drove there from Grapevine on Highway 26, it was impossible, of course, not to think about him. He'd been the quarterback of the 1988 Permian Panthers, and no one wore the weight of responsibility and pressure more than he did. You could see it in his eyes, darting downcast when the offense wasn't performing, searching for an answer that wouldn't come. His hands shook in the huddle, but that wasn't the Mike that came back to me. Of all the players I wrote about, he was the most mysterious. His intellectual curiousness had been singular in a town in which there was virtually no curiousness about anything beyond the Ector County line. He reminded me of a tortoise, sticking his head out to say something funny and insightful and surprising, then ducking his head back in again. He was an elusive interview. After 5 minutes, he inevitably said, "I gotta go," as if sustained human interaction was unbearably uncomfortable. I was the first to arrive, sitting on a bench underneath a rusty pavilion. I was nervous, so I smoked a cigarette. I had seen him about 10 years earlier during initial showings of the film Friday Night Lights. We had spoken only briefly. I wondered how open he would be, or if, after 5 minutes, he would look at me and once again say, "I gotta go." I knew that in the past he had been reluctant to talk about the book or himself. "People always won't talk about the book, but I don't care," he told the Odessa American in 1998. That was a long time ago. Now, it was even more of a long time ago. Mike ambles up in shorts and a white T-shirt and a green hat with the logo of the Dallas Stars. His legs are spindly, a reminder of his athleticism in football and baseball and golf. There are greater layers of padding in the face and stomach like the rest of us, but he didn't look much older. When he wasn't heaping abuse on himself, there had been something whimsical about Mike, a gift for making mischief. In what I thought was a seminal moment during the season, he asked me if I wanted to go snipe hunting. As a damn Yankee, I had no idea that snipes didn't exist. The whole point was to drop off a naive idiot deep in the middle of nowhere and make him walk the long road home after he realized there were no such creatures. When Mike invited me, I considered it the breakthrough. I'd finally broken the cultural barrier. It was only through the grace of an assistant coach that it was called off. "The farther the better," Mike confessed now. "Show up with stitches and cactus sticking out of your butt." "Well, you might be Ivy League, but I've never seen a redneck fall that hard for the old snipe hunting trick." Touché. If time had made him a little bit more corpulent, it has also made him actually chatty. I'm the one who has trouble getting him to shut up. He lives in the small town of Decatur, about 40 miles to the north. Much of his family is there, including his mother and two sisters. He works as a lease manager for Devon Energy, overseeing roughly 50 wells. He says he was hired because of his natural anal tendencies. Much as she was in Odessa, his mom is the center of his sphere. She's 80 now, still living on her own in a government-assisted apartment. She can be ornery, but Mike's used to it. She also has a Texas-sized strain of independence, like the time about 5 years ago she was in a car accident as a passenger. She insisted to the medics at the scene she was fine and would just walk home across two busy lanes of traffic. They knew her, so they were all too familiar with her stoicism. They took her to the local emergency room and then had to airlift her to a hospital for a broken leg, broken ribs, and internal bleeding. As Mike retells the story, it's clear that if they had not taken her to the emergency room in the first place, she would still be walking home. When the film version of Friday Night Lights came out in 2004, her portrayal had been exaggerated. She was depicted as being heavily dependent on medication when Mike actually has to goad her to take any prescription. I was there when Mike saw the film for the first time, and his discomfort was obvious. I also couldn't help but wonder what his mother thought. "I wish they had let that lady wear some makeup," she told her son after they saw it together. That was her only comment about the film, despite an astonishing and beautiful performance by Lucas Black in the role of her son. "It's just not our way." Touché. Mike still plays golf, although not nearly as much as he used to before knee surgery. At one point, he was on the Ironman Tour, in which you play 27 holes in a single stretch. He likes to go trout fishing in northern Arkansas on the White River. He still has couch potato tendencies, is hooked on Duck Dynasty and the History Channel. He fancies the mystery novels of Daniel Silva, with their historical and religious references and international intrigue. He is a wonderful uncle to his nieces and nephews, but he has never married. "I respect women too much to have them put up with my crap," he said. He went to Baylor University after Permian and played quarterback on the scout team as a freshman. He might have made the traveling squad had he stayed, but the part of Permian football he liked the best, the undersized underachiever becoming overachiever, was absent at Baylor. "Year-round great athletes. Big kids that can run. At Permian, you were around kids that just didn't look the part, but they got it done." An exceptional academic opportunity came Mike's way because of the book. An English professor at Austin College was so taken with him after reading it that he said the school would give him a full scholarship. The school in Sherman, Texas was private and small and highly regarded. At the time, I never understood why he didn't truly pursue it. It bothered me. I was disappointed, I was younger then and easily disappointed. I now realize the judgment